This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Back in 2012, I hosted a Connecticut Forum conversation with food advocate Michael Pollan, DEEP Commissioner Dan Esty, and environmental activist Majora Carter. A lot of Carter's work revolves around the issue of environmental justice for urban communities.
We have this image that away actually exists. You know, you flush something away, you know, things go down the drain. It's like, really? No, they end up in somebody's neighborhood.
Today, we take a closer look at some of the neighborhoods she's talking about. Scholar and author Dorsita Taylor joins us to talk about her latest book, Toxic Communities. In it, she writes about some of the hazardous, toxic environments that many low-income and minority communities are forced to live in every day. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. If you have thoughts about environmental justice in Connecticut and in America today, Dorsita Taylor is an associate professor of environmental sociology at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. She's the author of Toxic Communities, and she joins us from the studios at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor today. Dorsita Taylor, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Why write this book about this topic right now?
Well, I have been studying and working in the field for quite some time, and the research around environmental justice has actually been quite prolific for about the past 3 to 4 decades, and it's gotten to the point where I thought it would be helpful to have a book that focuses first and foremost on the siting of noxious and hazardous facilities, because that is one of the largest areas of research, but also the most contentious area of environmental research. And it's gotten to the point where there's so many articles, so many books, that that a lot of people have trouble kind of sorting through it all. And I thought one of the roles I could play would be not only to look at this literature, review it, but organize it as a body of thought, put a theoretical framework behind it, but also use it as a way of saying we can't rest on our laurels. There still needs to be more research, and here are some possible avenues in which this research could go in the future.
Maybe you can talk about some of the ways in which these hazardous and toxic facilities end up in the backyards of low-income or minority communities. Maybe you can tell us a story about an example that might spark some ideas for us here.
One of the most celebrated cases is a case from Warren County, North Carolina, where this was a very small African-American community in the county in North Carolina that had the highest proportion of African Americans. And this particular landfill siting was different from most of the others, where it would happen and then the community would think about it and may or may not respond. But these community activists, a group of both African American and white activists, decided to really protest it. The landfill was put in the community after a company decommissioning various parts, and PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, were the byproduct of what was coming off of their waste stream, and they decided really to just put the PCBs in a truck and spew it along North Carolina roadways. Once the PCB was discovered, they realized they needed a place to put the contaminated soil, and the state chose this particular small African-American community to put it in. So protests really erupted. The protesters were arrested, hundreds of protesters, men, women, children arrested. And so it gained national attention, and groups like the United Church of Christ, the Commission for Racial Justice, members of that group, congressmen, all kind of converged on the community and helped with the protests. In the aftermath of that particular event, community leaders and activists really started to ask the question, why was this particular community in North Carolina chosen as opposed to any other community? And was this a larger pattern? Was this happening elsewhere? They were told that they were chosen because they had the appropriate soil to build a landfill on. But when you look at what was going on there, the landfill was actually placed in an area where the bottom of the landfill was really only a few feet above the water table. And that was one of the things that the community protested, that the EPA was actually bypassing its own regulations of wanting the landfills to be between 20 to 30 feet above the water level whenever one's developed. In this case, they were just a few feet above the water level, about 7 feet. Mm-hmm. And so it really brought to the fore this new area of research to look at the spatial distribution of hazardous wastes, landfills, noxious facilities, and to see whether or not there was a correlation with race and class.
And that's what your book does, is it organizes some of this research over the years. And we're talking with author Dorsita Taylor, who joins us today from the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. Her book is called Toxic Communities, and we're talking about environmental justice issues in the program today. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I wanted you to start with a story because sometimes the anecdotes of specific examples of environmental injustice are so powerful and do galvanize people, but then the patterns that come from that, what you see and other researchers see, maybe you can explain a little bit more about what you found over these many decades now of research. How prevalent is it that the siting of these toxic plants and other types of dumps are sited in low-income communities?
Yes, even though it is still some people dispute the fact that there's a race connection to this, and there are studies that do show that, including studies that are either sponsored by waste disposal companies or conducted by them. The vast majority of the studies, and we're talking about hundreds of these studies, really show that when you do spatial analysis, when you use GIS and you look at the siting, if you take an equally situated white community, if you control for race, class, occupation, income of the residents, and you compare it to a similar community of color, particularly if it's an African-American community, you do get a higher likelihood of such a community being adjacent to landfills, hazardous facilities, polluting facilities, noxious nuisance facilities. So there is a race dimension to this, definitely, that we've seen in national studies, in studies of metropolitan areas. There's a class dimension. So class plays a role, i.e. poverty. But when you control for each in regression models, race is by far the strongest predictor of where you're going to find disproportionate amounts of these, i.e. that community has excessive amounts of such facilities.
In your mind, is this about overt racism, the type that would say we're going to put this in a black community versus a white community, or more a type of a softer racism but still very real that revolves around political power? Many minority communities don't have the same clout within, say, a state legislature as a white community in the suburbs. Which of these two do you think is really the cause here in many of the cases that you studied?
Both dynamics are at play. So there are cases that when you do look at them, especially in cases where the low-income community or the African-American community, the minority community exists before the placement of these facilities, you do see very deliberate attempts. And Native American reservations are good examples of this, where there are very deliberate attempts to place, for instance, nuclear wastes or the waste stream coming off of utility and companies or nuclear reactors in the reservation. They're very clear examples of those. We can look at the Skull Valley Goshute tribe in Utah, where they were approached to take nuclear waste. So we see that happening very clearly. However, we do see the second dynamic, which is a dynamic of what's called the path of least resistance. Look for communities that are least likely to resist. And such communities typically have high unemployment, low educational attainment of the residents, if there are excessive amount of very old people in the community. They also look for community corporations. They look for communities where there are low percentages of environmentalists and low percentages of people who vote regularly or who are participants in voluntary association community organizations. So there are definitely patterns where at the outset it might not necessarily be let's go and look for the poorest low-income minority community we can find. But if you look for these other factors, high unemployment, low education, low income, it often conflates with low, with poverty and minority communities. And so there are direct and indirect forms of racism that we do see that helps to explain some of these sightings.
I want to get to a phone call here. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. As we talk in the program about environmental racism with Dorcita Taylor, her book is called Toxic Communities. Dan is calling from New York. Hi there, Dan. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, good morning. And Dorcita, this is Dan Durrett. It's great to hear your voice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On your new book.
Thanks.
We worked when I was director at the National Council for Science and the Environment.
Wonderful,
and it's great
yes.
to see that you're still fighting the good fight.
Thanks.
Dan, what's on your mind?
Well, my question is goes to the core of fighting environmental justice. And in regards to the record of the Obama administration, how would you rate the actions of our first African-American president, given that people of color communities are disproportionately impacted by siting issues? And the flip side of that, if I may, is the whole issue of diversity. We're still fighting with the larger green organizations to increase their diversity.
Thanks. Interesting questions. So in regard to Obama, one of the things he did very early on in his presidency was to elevate the issue of environmental justice. He appointed Lisa Jackson, the first African-American head of the EPA, and he also appointed a lot of people of color to very prominent positions within the EPA and within other agencies. So that speaks to both the diversity component, but also to the environmental justice piece. The administration has also spent a fair bit of time working on evaluating what's the effectiveness of, say, the Environmental Justice Executive Order that came out in 1994 that really put agencies on notice that they really need to not just administer the environment or, quote-unquote, care for the environment, but they need to look at imbalances, disproportionality in how their policies impact various communities. And so the Obama administration has been forthcoming in assessing the effectiveness of the different agencies, and to really push for greater both transparency, but looking into things. For instance, if you look at the Title VI complaints that communities could file, because it was mentioned earlier that many communities don't have access to many of the stakeholder processes that allow them to fight back. And one of the tools that low-income communities used to use was to use a Title VI filing to question the permitting of noxious and hazardous facilities. And those had gotten to the point where they just weren't even being reviewed. And so there's been definitely an increase in the number of reviews of those and looking more seriously at community complaints. Mm. To your second question,
what I may ask you to hold on the second question just because it's going to be part of a conversation that we're going to be continuing throughout the course of this program, and I think it's a very interesting one that I want to spend more time with, but we do have to take a break. Dorcita Taylor is with us. She's Associate Professor of Environmental Sociology at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. She's the author of a new book called Toxic Communities. We're talking about environmental justice issues. We'll bring it home here to Connecticut, and we'll take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Coming up next, Where where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with author Dorcita Taylor, who is Associate Professor of Environmental Sociology at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. Her book is called Toxic Communities, and it takes a look at some of the problems of disproportionate siting where sometimes low-income communities, not just urban communities, but rural communities as well, face an awful lot of the brunt of bad environmental policy. We're also taking your phone calls today, 860-275-7266. A little bit later on in the program, we're going to be talking more about how perhaps more diversity within the environmental movement might help to solve some of these problems of environmental justice. I want to quickly get to a phone call, though. Lillian is calling from Springfield, Mass. Hi there, Lillian.
Hi there.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to know if Ms. Taylor, as well covered in her research, other cities. For example, I was interested in Rhode Island in particular because of the when I visit there frequently, my grandsons, the water that they consume, majority of the population buy their water. So I was like saying, well, what's going on over there? We're not even a third world country that people have to buy bottled water to drink. And I even tasted the water at one point, and I called the water company because I was like, what's going on with your water? It tastes like lead or whatever. And then I wanted to know, does that environmental situation lead to illnesses such as leukemia and other types of cancer?
Lillian, thank you so much for your question. And you heard her, Dorcita Taylor. Obviously, you studied an awful lot of the places around the country where some of these issues persist. I guess I'm wondering, Rhode Island, Northeast, Connecticut, the places where we live.
Yes, I tried to do as broad a coverage as possible. I didn't do anything on the water situation in Rhode Island per se, but the book does touches on an African American community in parts of New London, Connecticut, where that community was being impacted by designs on quote unquote developing their neighborhood, i.e. Take most of the homes by eminent domain and then turn them over to industry to develop corporate businesses. So there is some in New England, parts of I do a little bit on New Haven with residential segregation, and certainly in parts of New York City. I'm always covering a lot in New York City. But the issue of water and water quality is a good one that the listener raised because it is rather ubiquitous around the country. In low-income communities and African-American communities where the water source gets tainted, people do drink and use the water a lot, and that has often in many cases led to illnesses. The case of a small African-American community in Alabama, Triana, Alabama, is one in which the water was polluted by DDT, by a corporation, the Calabama Company, and the community, they ate the fish, they bathed in water, and it took a very long time before the government studied the wildlife around that African-American community for almost two decades and worried about wildlife dying off before the actual people in the community were informed that the fish they were eating was tainted with DDT. And yes, they had very high incidence of cancer in that community, still do. And that is seen in other places. The whole neighborhood of what's called Cancer Alley, the whole region, from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, Louisiana, that's about 90 miles off the Mississippi River. There's so many cancers in those African-American communities from all the petrochemical companies that surround those small black communities. Many of those communities were actually slave plantations, and the African-Americans remained on the plantation after the Civil War, and the masters ran away and left the plantation and developed long-standing African-American communities. They owned their land, but many of those are being heavily poisoned, and so we see high cancer rate. Hence the name Cancer Alley, because there's so much of that. So the listener does have her finger on the pulse of some of those dynamics and relationships. And yes, water is heavily connected to those kinds of illnesses that we do see.
If you have questions about environmental justice issues in our area, in Connecticut, in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, 860-275-7266. You can always get online with us at Where We Live, both on Twitter and on Facebook. I want to bring in Amity Doolittle, who's senior lecturer and research scientist at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. You've done research looking at land use practices in New Haven, and you've been raising some of these same issues we're talking about. Welcome to our program, first of all. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the story of Beaver Pond Park in New Haven.
Right. Well, I've been really interested in looking at the urban landscape and thinking about it as sort of a living document that tells us a very long, complex story about histories of how different communities and areas have sort of grown, how the environment has changed, and why we see particular patterns in terms of demographics and land use. And for me, Beaver Ponds Park, and for many people in New Haven, is just a really fascinating case study because it's a park very much of a wetlands, a lot of areas where people do not use much but are used for migrating animals and birds. And so it's considered as a nice piece of wildness in the middle of New Haven. But at the same time, it divides two very, very different communities, Beaver Hills on one side and New Hallville on the other side. And the history of how those two different communities developed is something that helps us understand why there are differential levels of interest in the park at the moment. So on the New Hallville side, which is very much a lower-income minority area, it grew out of the growth of industry in New Haven in the late 1800s when the Winchester Repeating Arms Company and the Newhall Carriage Company and so many companies developed. There was a huge demand for laborers who came from many from the South and from all over the country to work in these jobs. And the community developed very, very rapidly. So lots of small houses and lots of tenement houses and very houses very, very close together. And then, as I think many people know, the industry sort of died off in New Haven. And so we have a community that came and built around industry, which is no longer there, and as a result is really left in a position where there's not a lot of employment. So New Hallville is kind of known for the fact that it has extremely low employment rates, very low educational attainment rates comparative to other parts of New Haven, low income, low housing values, and so forth, higher rates of poverty. Then on the other side of Beaver Ponds Park, we have Beaver Hills, which was developed in 1908. It was 100 acres of farmland, and it was sort of one of the nation's first planned communities, where the Meade family, who owned the land, decided to cut it up into 100 lots, and they put restrictive covenants on that land, so they very, very much shaped what that community would look like. And these covenants included things like it had to be a single-family house. It had to cost $9,000 at the time, which is sort of $230,000 in today's terms. It had to have a 30-foot setback from the curb. And, you know, right within the deed, it said you had to have one of five housing designs because we want to have a uniform line and we want to keep out sort of undesirable cheapness of design. So you can see really, really different histories and resulting demographics in those communities. So fast forward to present day with Beaver Ponds Park, those on the new Beaver Hills side have great access to the park. There are paths, there are signage, people enjoy it, they speak very fondly of it. They are sort of designed or they have come together as guardians of the park and talk about the importance of the natural beauty and tranquility that one can find in these areas. If you go across the park to New Hallville and ask questions about, you know, what is their perception of and how important is this park in their life, you get very different answers. Many people have not heard of it. They don't see an importance of it. There is a 7-foot hurricane fence that restricts access, so they don't really have easy way to enter it. And so you see that that the opportunities in which different communities have to enjoy and make use of this park are very different. And I think one of the topics that I hope we talk about is the fact that many people are quick in this kind of scenario to say that minority communities are not interested in the environment. And by digging a little bit deeper into the dynamics of what's happening in New Hallville, you can very clearly say that's not the case. They're just not interested in the same type of environment as those who are considered talking about wilderness areas and wetlands and animal migration and that sort of thing.
Well, and that takes us to this next part of the conversation, I think, very well. And I'd like to get Dorcita Taylor's view on this. You know, when we think about what the environment is, if you look at the homepages of the major environmental organizations, places like the NRDC or the Sierra Club, you see logos and pictures with trees and forests and animals and wide open vistas. The iconic image, for instance, of climate change for many of these organizations is a polar bear adrift on an ice floe. And I guess I'm wondering if that kind of expression of what environmentalism means, it provides a disconnect with many of the communities, Dorcita, that you have studied.
Definitely, the discourse and framing of it is extremely important to whether or not to how you engage people and who is engaged. And if we get back to the issue of, say, the parks, one of the things I do in toxic communities is to show how green space was deliberately used to racially segregate communities. So it's not coincidental when you look at something like Beaver Pond that a poor African-American or poor community is put on one side with very limited access, and then the high-income, predominantly white community has access to that space. That was a segregationist strategy, and the restrictive covenants often, especially up until the 1930s and so, had deeds that denied housing to blacks, to Jews, to Asians in those new developments. So that's a part of the story. And even though the current generation might not even know that history, those early families that lived in New Hallville knows in the city of New Haven how the highways were used, that the I-34 connector was used to deliberately restrict African Americans in some of the worst parts of the city, how New Hallville was racially segregated and denied amenities. And so that also feeds into what is that green space, how it looks, do you have access to it? Many African American children today associate some of that green space with things like if they have allergies and their asthma kicks up and they're allergic to some of the plants or the bushes in that space, they'll tell you, I don't like going to that space, or I don't use it, I don't cut across it. You have to then dig deeper to find out why, what is going on. And so sometimes it's related to illnesses, and there's a whole new branch of research that's looking particularly at children and exposure to pollen and illnesses, how they're responding to overgrown areas, to wetlands areas, especially if they don't have access to medical care. Mm-hmm. And when they get sick, it's a matter of life or death for them, and they have trouble getting to the emergency room. It gets reflected in, I don't like that space, and we have to kind of dig deeper. And the framing of these spaces as spaces of access and openness and beauty for one community and not the other really plays into how folks see it. And for conservation groups, they're not very good at communicating with low-income communities about the space. Their idea of communication is to take a group of like young inner-city minority kids out to the park to clean up the trash. Why would you want to be happy to run out and clean up the trash of a park that you can't use or you don't have access to? Mm. It makes very little sense.
I'd love Amity Doolittle to pick up a bit on this and some of the themes that you're hearing here.
Yeah, so, I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Dr. Taylor's saying, but one of the things that I've seen in a really positive way in New Haven and in New Hallville is the work of the group URI, or the Urban Resources Initiative, which has done a lot of work to actually change how they are communicating to people about the environment and how they're trying to build very much from a bottom up what do people see as beauty in the natural landscape. And you see this happening in New Hallville with their work. The New Hallville residents, when they are thinking about, I want more open space, I want more nature, they're building community gardens in derelict lots or in, you know, little pocket parks, pocket, what we call pocket parks, where maybe there's an intersection or a stop sign. And they speak very clearly about the importance of the nature, the natural world and the garden, not just for the environmental issues, but for the importance of building community cohesion, building up community pride, and making streets safer for families. So that kind of engagement with the natural world is something that they're very, very interested in and resonates with their way of life.
I guess to you, Emily Doolittle, I'm wondering if because the next part of our conversation, we're going to be talking a bit more about the large-scale environmental organizations that I mentioned earlier, whether or not more diversity within those organizations would help to change some of the overall conversation that we're having. How much of it do you think really, the problem really resides there, that we as a society, when we say environment, we're not really thinking about the urban environment. We're not really thinking about the pocket park. We're thinking about a national park. We're thinking, if at all, we're thinking about climate change over something like the siting of a power plant in an urban neighborhood. Do you think that there's a way to change that conversation, Amity?
Right. Well, I think it is being changed, and it's being changed rapidly. I mean, many of us who grew up in the early American environmental movement are very, very attached to wilderness areas and natural parks, and for good reasons. They bring a real sense of awe in nature and the world around us, and they make people more interested in the natural world. But it is something that only a very few people within the country can actually reach, and particularly minorities and African Americans do not visit national parks. But most importantly, if you think about it, we are just increasingly an urban world. Cities are growing faster than ever. You know, we have more megacities in the last 50 years than we have ever had before, and expect another doubling of it in the next 10 years. And with that comes a need to think very differently about how we can live in environment and have the environment, the natural world with us, opposed to being something that we go to that's far away. So how can we bring it to within how we interact in the city in our everyday lives? And I think this conversation is changing, but again, there's a strong legacy of wilderness protection that we need to grow away from. Or at least we need to match it with equal enthusiasm for the urban areas.
Amity Doolittle is senior lecturer and research scientist at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. She joined us today by phone from New Haven. Thank you so much. I truly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
When we come back from our break, we'll continue with Dorsita Taylor, who is an associate professor of environmental sociology at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. She's the author of a book called Toxic Communities. It has us talking about environmental justice and environmental activism in the country today. We're going to be talking a bit more about diversity within the environmental movement coming up next. If you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266, or you can email us where we live at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, from Boston's new arts czar to Mass MoCA's big expansion announcement, we'll learn about some of Massachusetts's long-term plans to support arts and culture. We'll take a look at the arts here in our state and see if there's anything we can learn from our neighbors to the north. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Hope you can join the conversation. Today we're talking about environmental justice with Dorsita Taylor. Her book is called Toxic Communities. She joins us from the University of Michigan today. Joining us now by phone is Dr. Robert Bullard. He's dean of the Barbara Jordan Mickey Leland School of Public Affairs at Texas Southern University. And he's worked on these issues as well for many years. Dr. Bullard, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One of the conversations that we were having in the last segment that I wanted to bring you into was about diversity within some of the large-scale environmental organizations that we've mentioned already, like the NRDC or the Sierra Club. There's a sense that environmentalism is about something different than environmental justice for urban communities and even rural communities. That's, of course, not across the board, but it's long been associated with these organizations. Maybe diversity of these organizations has something to do with it. What do you say?
Well, I think, you know, if you have to look at the history of the, many of these environmental and conservation organizations as they were founded, and the history of the fact that many cases they were created separate and apart from many of the communities that had the most problems. For example, in the southern United States, African Americans could not join these organizations. And so as you start to look at their history and their legacy, it is not coincidental that in many cases they were basically white middle class organizations. Mm. And it was not until the environmental justice movement challenged the idea that if these organizations really wanted to be a national organization, an international organization, they should reflect that diversity. And so it's been, you know, in some cases these organizations are more than 100 years old. And so the fact that they don't look like America is no surprise.
I'm wondering if you might help us pick up on the conversation that we were having with Amity Doolittle about some of the work she's done in New Haven. There's a sense sometimes when you look at urban communities and communities of color that when asked, people don't have some of the same thoughts about the environment, maybe don't care about the natural space next to them. Of course, that's a very broad brush. A lot of people say, well, it's because they care about a lot of other things in their communities that aren't the environment. How much of a role do you think that this plays, in many cases, urban communities are concerned about things other than environmental justice first and foremost, and that's one of the reasons why there's a lack of concerted activism that maybe there is in some other wings of the environmental movement?
Well, I think you made a really broad brush assumption. Just because many people of color and urban residents don't belong to many of the mainstream organizations does not provide a good indicator in terms of their caring about the environment. The environmental justice movement and many people of color in cities and rural areas define the environment as where we live, work, play, learn, and worship. And you don't have to be a member of an organization to care about the environment. As a matter of fact, when you look at the polling and ask people, do you think, for example, climate change? The polling numbers that come out is that people of color are more concerned about climate change and are more supportive of climate change initiative because of the fact that climate change impacts poor people and people of color first, worst, and longest. And I think when you start to look at this whole issue of diversity, diversity entails more than just whether or not a mainstream organization or national conservation organization like NRDC or Sierra Club will diversify its board, add one or two people, or have people of color on that staff. Diversity also means making sure that we diversify the funding, how the money gets doled out. And over the last, 50-100 years or so, the bulk of the money has gone to the mainstream organizations, and there are a number of studies that show that in 2001, only less than 5% of the environmental dollars went to people of color organizations dealing with social justice. In 2011, in 2012, that number had increased to 15%. But if you look at people of color, make up over 37% of the U.S. population. So the money doesn't flow to where the problems are. And if you look at, the data and look at, the reports and the books, including Dr. Taylor's books and at least, a dozen of my, 18 books on this topic, you'll see that the myth, there's a myth that people of color are not concerned about the environment. It's just like saying that some people are not religious just because they don't go to church. Hmm. That you can't make that leap.
Yeah, and again, I wasn't making that leap. A lot of that leap came from our last conversation where when asked in certain communities, especially in New Haven, in the last bit of research we were talking about, sometimes there's a sense that urban communities care about something different. It doesn't sound necessarily like what the mainstream environmental groups are caring about. This idea of people of color, though, Dr. Bullard, actually thinking that climate change is a more important issue than the population at large. This is probably a really important one for these mainstream organizations to grasp onto. As we've seen here, poll after poll coming out of Yale recently, where they take a look at Americans' attitudes toward climate change, it seems as though after a peak some years ago, now people consider climate change in America to be less important than maybe it should be. You're saying that not only is the communities of color in America growing substantially, so maybe that's a reason why mainstream environmentalism should be paying more attention to them, but also they seem to care about something that mainstream environmentalism very much wants to put on the front burner, and largely, you know, Americans aren't caring as much about climate change as they should right now.
Well, I think, once again, how you define the issue oftentimes will determine what kinds of results you get. When the mainstream organizations started to define climate change to include health, to include not just CO2, but also these other pollutants, to include, you know, dirty coal-fired power plants that are disproportionately located in communities of color, and to talk about transportation issues and the impact of transportation energy, clean energy on communities. When you look at the fact that the numbers have stayed pretty steady in terms of communities of color wanting to have clean air because we live in disproportionately live in cities of non-attainment, having access to a good clean affordable transportation because we're least likely to own a car, and having energy renewable energy and different alternative energies. Because we're likely to have lower incomes and not having those resources to pay high prices for energy. And so when you start to redefine and recalibrate how these issues are played out in policy, you start to get more and more individuals that you would not think who would say, I'm an environmentalist. When you ask people if you care about the air, and there is no black air, no Hispanic air, no white air. And if you ask people, you know, do you care about what's in your water and what's, you know, in your food, you'll find that most people will say, I care about all three of those. But if you say, well, how concerned are you in terms of working on these issues, you may get a different result.
Mm.
And I think the fact that it's important that these mainstream organizations understand that the change in demographics of this country by 2042, we will be a majority people of color country, that it's time for them to start to own up to the fact that they can no longer look like they look.
Mm.
And the fact that diversity, as I said, it's about diversity in terms of board staff and agendas, but also in terms of resources. I think our environmental movement should not make some of the mistakes that the civil rights movement made in terms of just trying to desegregate or integrate, you know, white businesses and white organizations, and not taking into account that there's a whole lot of people of color organizations, indigenous organizations, that also need funding, they need support. And if we neglect the latter and just concentrate on getting people of color in these white organizations, we will make a dramatic mistake. Because I don't think there will be, you know, many of these organizations will be, white organizations will be taken over by people of color as those demographics change. There's still resistance in dealing with some of these issues that some individuals define as social issues, issues of justice, equity, and fairness. In some cases, there's pushback.
And I'm sorry, I just want to break in. I apologize. I just want to break in quickly because I want to get Dr. Taylor's thoughts on this issue before we run too low on time.
Yes. Hi, Bob. How are you doing? I do agree strongly with what Dr. Bullard is saying, because the National Diversity Report that I put out last year showed quite strongly that there's big disparities from the environmental grant-making sector in terms of who gets the funding dollars, and very few of those dollars do go to organizations, particularly if they're founded by people of color and run by people of color. So that's one of the issues that definitely has to be changed. The question of how we talk about the environment and how we ask the questions really absolutely determines what answers we get. And to go back to the New Haven studies, depending on how those questions are framed, gives us a certain kind of answer about whether or not people of color or communities of color care about the parks. We see the same thing in Detroit, where there's a lot of open space. And it's interesting that certain researchers go to these communities and ask a lot of questions, and they come back with the understanding that the communities care about something else. If you ask the right kinds of questions, and if you look at the organizations in Detroit, communities like Grace Lee Boggs Run, those are communities that are talking about sustainability, carbon footprint. They are greening the communities. They're putting green spaces throughout these communities. And yes, they will be sometimes mixing it with edible gardens. And it's being infused. There are Afrocentric schools in like Detroit where the entire curriculum is focused around environment. You often don't hear about these because it's often assumed that people of color really either don't think about it, or because they talk about it differently, it's not environment. So we really have to understand that. I just also want to quickly point to the issue of, say, African Americans visiting national parks. And it was said earlier that we don't. And that is really not a good reflection of what goes on. The African-American community is also very diverse. There are middle-class, upper-class African-Americans that do visit the national parks, and there are others who can't afford to go. So we have to be very careful about making blanket statements about not visiting national parks. I've been to every one of them, and I've dragged my kids through just about every single one of them. And not only do I see African-Americans in the American parks, my last time I was in Costa Rica looking at national parks, there was a busload of about 300 African-Americans who was on a black family vacation, and they were there in the Virgin Islands. I've seen it. I've seen it in Mexico. If you look at the American South, there's a tradition of having black family reunions in national parks, in farms, in green spaces. And so we really just need to be more nuanced about that. And the issue now is both an issue of diversifying national organizations, but it's also recognizing the huge important work that African American organizations, institutions, and activists have been doing around environment, and then putting the infrastructure within those organizations to work within those communities, because they have a better understanding of those communities and they can motivate those communities more effectively.
The infrastructure, and as Dr. Bullard was saying earlier too, making sure that some of the dollars that are necessary are flowing toward these efforts as well, because without the funding, it's going to be difficult, Professor Taylor.
It is very challenging, but what we can look at is the incredible impact those very small, under-resourced organizations have had on our understanding of the American environment and people's experiences in the last 4 to 5 decades. Consider what could be done if they had the budget of the Big Ten organizations, the millions of dollars that those organizations have. And there is that distrust. We talked a little bit earlier about that sense of people of color not caring about the environment or not understanding. In the research that I did last year, that idea is still present in about 4 out of 10 of the organizations, in the sense of feeling that. And as Dr. Bullard pointed out, not only do people of color support the environment more strongly, and polls done since the 1990s have shown that, black congressional leaders also are the most pro-environmental voting part of the Senate and the House.
Well, and it's part of, I think, then for our future conversations, maybe a little bit more nuance, more of asking the right questions. I want to thank Dorcetta Taylor for her book, Toxic Communities, and for this great conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you also to Dr. Robert Bullard from Texas Southern University. Continue the conversation at WNPR.org. This is where we live.